This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Yeah, it's hard work being a dung beetle. I mean, there's the burrowing, the harvesting, and in some cases, the rolling of animal waste. All that hard work doesn't just benefit the beetle, though. No, no, no. It is a monumental impact and importance to us in this ecosystem as well. And now the oft-unsung dung beetle is getting its appreciation, the appreciation it deserves. The North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh will celebrate dung beetles alongside other beetle species at this year's Bug Fest, a free one-day event on Saturday, September 21st. And joining me now is Clyde Sorensen, a professor of entomology at NC State and a beetle expert. Hello, Clyde.
How you doing?
I'm doing very well. Now, tell me when you got first interested, because I guess we all are when little kids.
But... In beetles?
Yeah.
I'm kind of a of all living things kind of guy. When I was a kid, I was fascinated by everything, but I found green June bugs, June beetles, as a kid and played with them. I found a Hercules beetle one time when I was about 7 or 8 years old, and that was a pretty spectacular event. So they're just like almost all other living things, they're fascinating to me, and beetles are particularly fascinating because they're so incredibly diverse.
They are, and I was surprised to learn how many species there are.
So yeah, right now our best understanding puts the number of species of beetles in the world somewhere between 350 and 400,000 species.
300. So how does that compare to the rest of the animal kingdom,
so,
species-wise?
Mammals, we're mammals. There are somewhere in the neighborhood of 5,000 or so species of mammals, maybe, you know, give or take 500. Birds, there are about 10,000 species of birds. Insects altogether, over 1 million species, and with certainly at least another 1 million to identify that folks haven't even recognized
yet.
And then beetles are a huge chunk of that.
So that's something like a third of the identified species of insects, if I did my math right.
Real
but you said over a million.
Yeah,
and
real
so
close.
That's amazing. What accounts for, and how long have they been around?
So beetles have probably been around somewhere between 250 and 300 million years.
So they know what they're doing. They're highly successful.
Very, very ancient. And because of the way a beetle is built, they can live in virtually any kind of habitat, and that's why we find them living in the water, inside trees, under piles of cow dung. They can live almost any place with the kind of wings they have and still maintain the ability to fly.
Including underwater. There's underwater. There's like the sea hunt. They got Mike Nelson. Anybody remember Mike Nelson?
Yes, there's lots of beetles that are... that dive after prey, and they carry a little air bell of water or air with them under their wings when they dive, and
whoa, they carry it under their wings.
Yeah.
So what do they have to get? Like, do they use they draw the air then from an outside, like a nose?
So insects don't breathe through their nose; they breathe through their abdomen.
Yeah.
Little holes alongside their abdomen, and so beetles have these really cool front wings called elytra. That's what makes them have that hard shell look to them.
Mm-hmm.
And the diving beetles have underneath their elytra, they have a lot of little hairs that trap air. And so they go underwater, they have this bubble of air trapped around their abdomen, and it functions like almost like an aqua lung. And as they deplete the oxygen in that little bubble of air, more oxygen moves in from the water. And so they can stay underwater for a really long time, chasing minnows, tadpoles, whatever.
Then the oxygen is being absorbed through their skin, just the way a land beetle would. But
right,
it's now trapped
under
there
through the little holes in their abdomen.
But that means they also have to be able to extract oxygen from water, or at least the bubbles, the dissolved oxygen.
Yeah,
right?
The bubble pulls dissolved oxygen from the water as it's depleted in the bubble.
This
is really
very
cool.
And this also the number of species suggests a greater amount of specialization. Right, they figured out how to find the niche.
That's what's really remarkable about beetles is if there is a niche to live in, there's probably a beetle living in it, and so they can occupy little tiny patches of habitats. They can occupy habitats that most other animals simply can't exploit because they can't fly to find them. They can't fly to exploit them. And so they're really, really powerful.
And the dung beetle figured out long ago that the world is full of enough food for them to actually make a living.
Dung beetles are just one kind of beetle. They're in the family Scarabaeidae, which means nothing to y'all.
But scarab, I heard
likely,
scarab in there.
Scarab is probably significant. So scarab beetles are kind of historically significant, right? So the sacred scarab in ancient Egyptian religion, it's a dung beetle. It's a big, big dung beetle.
Wait, the scarab, those are dung beetles?
It's a big dung beetle.
Oh, dear.
Yep.
But they must have known that, and yet it was a, I mean, right, because you would have paid attention.
Oh, yeah.
Anybody can build a pyramid
so,
knows what that beetle is doing.
Yeah, so they actually worshipped it because it was a dung beetle, because they saw it was one of the rollers. We could get into this in a little bit, but
yeah.
It was one of those that makes a ball of dung and then rolls it away and buries it. And they saw in that process there a metaphor for the passage of the sun. And then they also saw a metaphor for their belief in a rebirth after death, in that they would bury this ball of stuff,
mm-hmm.
and then sometime later a brand new beetle would come out of the ground.
Uh-huh.
And so that all figured into their religious belief.
Kind of spontaneous generation back then, but also an observation that everything is useful. I mean, everybody understood, I think, back then what it was they were rolling. And a deep appreciation for the fact that this is vital to all of us, that this be reprocessed. So I'm wondering, it's great for the beetle. Obviously, they figured out a way to make a living from this stuff that the rest of us are no longer using. However, I wonder if it matters to us that they've processed this, or if it would have been fine just where it was.
Well, no, actually, dung beetles provide us a tremendous service and the ecosystem in general, in that there are two main groups of insects that exploit animal waste once it's been deposited, and those two groups are dung beetles and flies. And we find flies a lot less appealing, and in fact flies a lot more problematic than beetles. And so dung beetles compete with flies for that resource, and they basically make it inaccessible or unusable to flies. And in the process, they also assist in putting a lot of the nutrients that are tied up in that material that we think has no nutrients left in it, but which is actually really, really rich in nutrients, back into the soil, back into the ground, back where plants can then reuse those resources.
Yeah, probably a more efficient way. If it were left on the ground, some of that would make its way, and then I suppose
some of it, but
in other places, the concentrations probably matter too.
Oh yeah, so it's a very important ecological function that they do bury this material, and it does. There's been research to document that it does have a positive impact on soil health.
Yeah, and I think this is, you just touched on, but I want you to tell us more in more detail, something that I was not aware of. I mean, you know, we think that waste is really not worth much of anything, but it, in fact, particularly herbivores, leave a lot behind, right?
Absolutely. In fact, if you want to kind of tuck that little fact back in the back of your head, think about the settlers that were going across the Great Plains 150 years ago. What was the main thing that they used to make their campfires? It was buffalo chips, which buffalo chips are just dried dung. So there's mm-hmm. lots of energy tied up in what's left over. In particular, animals like cattle and bison that eat grass, that's a very indigestible substance. They have to get the cooperation of large populations of these microorganisms in their guts to help them get what nutrients they can get out of it. But then what's left still has a lot of undigested plant material, plus it's got all this other stuff that those bacteria and other microorganisms have added to it. So it's incredibly nutritionally rich for the right animals. For the animal that produced it, there's nothing left to get out of it.
Right,
but
right.
For other animals, there's still a lot of value left.
And as you say, it then gets planted into the ground as well, so then it all becomes helpful to us. Dung beetles are not the only ones. We talked about the diving beetles. I have a question about the iridescent, the color, some of the, you know, the bright greens and all of that. I wonder what the adaptive value of that is.
So a lot of insects, including beetles, do have bright colors, and most of the time those colors are probably associated with species recognition, helping them sort out who they are and that they're interacting with the right individuals of their species for, say, reproduction. But a lot of times those bright colors do function actually as very effective camouflage, too, in the right circumstances.
Very cool. And what I learned in doing this is that cockroaches are not beetles, and fireflies are.
Fireflies are definitely beetles, yes.
Wow. And you made an interesting discovery recently when it came to fireflies that flash in synchrony, right? They flash together.
Right. So, recently, back in June, I was up at Grandfather Mountain to do a program and discovered a population of synchronous fireflies at Grandfather, which previously wasn't known. And these are really cool fireflies, when they occur in high densities, all the males flash together and then they go dark together. And then they flash together and they go dark together. And it's really kind of a magical thing to witness. And when I found it, I was absolutely giddy. I was jumping up and down like a little kid again.
Do we know what's going on there?
So why do they do that?
Why don't the others?
They do it when they're under really high population levels. And we think they do it so that everybody gets a chance to look for the girls. And for the girls to figure out where the guys are. Because if everybody was flashing just kind of helter-skelter, there would be very difficult to figure out one individual firefly's signal or to see the signals of the females on the ground.
Great argument against social media right there. Let's just, lots of messages, very confusing. Well, beetles can be helpful, of course, but they're often pests. And Kelly Oten is a Forest Health Monitoring Coordinator for the North Carolina Forest Service and joins me now. Hello, Kelly.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing great. It's good to have you here. Clyde Sorensen is still with us, Professor of Entomology at NC State. Tell us about the roles that beetles play in North Carolina's ecosystem. They're helpful, but they're also, they can be destructive.
Yeah. In typical years, a lot of beetles are basically background noise. They take out stressed or weakened trees and basically help allow the trees that are a lot more healthy to have more access to water and nutrients, and then themselves become healthier.
So that's the good news. But some of them, especially a lot of them are native to this area, but then we've brought in a lot from other sources.
We have. And we're battling them every year. It seems we're getting another threat showing up at our doorstep. And in recent years, probably our biggest problem has been the emerald ash borer. Just this summer, the numbers have skyrocketed and we now have 53 counties in the state that is positive for emerald ash borer.
Now, what do we do about this? Because we know on the one hand, I mean, we consider it a pest. And of course, the right now, I mean, we're talking about pine trees in other cases, which is a cash crop, right? And
that
can also be.
Yeah, pine trees are really important. A lot of people grow them basically as a long rotational crop. Like if you think of them as an agricultural cropping system, it is one. It's just over 25 or 30 years, whereas a lot of people think of a cropping system as a one-year seasonality thing. So that's when bark beetles become a lot bigger of a threat, is when they're threatening someone's livelihood and resources that have been there and need to be harvested in a certain number of years to, you know, gain money.
So the tension is obvious, and it's not an easy solution, but we've been here before when we try to wipe out the thing that we think is, you know, ruining us. And then we end up paying a bigger price. How do we manage all of this?
That's a good question and one that's really hard to answer. When it comes to invasives, I think the biggest thing that we need to remember is if it weren't for us, these wouldn't be a problem to begin with. Like we're the ones accidentally or intentionally moving them from place to place. And then when they get out of hand, you know, a lot of people feel the social responsibility to do something about it, whether it's continue to research, find solutions, and implement those solutions.
Now, there was one solution for a particular beetle in Canada that seemed to work, a wasp or a predatory wasp, but not working so well here?
Yeah, so we have a parasitoid wasp that is reared by the USDA aphis, which attacks the emerald ash borer. It's actually been successful in northern parts of the U.S. as well, in the Midwest. It's becoming established, and they're seeing slower mortality rates with ash trees. But we've been releasing them here. We have about 7 sites that we've released them at, and we've tried to recover them at one of our sites, and we were not successful. But looking at the emerald ash borer now, we think that we have a different life cycle than maybe they do in the northern part of the U.S. So these parasitoid wasps are emerging and looking for emerald ash borer to kill and attack. And they're not available.
The wrong time of year.
Yes.
So do we adjust their clock or find a different predator?
The idea would be to find a different parasitoid. When they first went over to the native range of emerald ash borer, they brought back 12 different species that keep emerald ash borer at bay in their native range where they're not pests.
All fascinating stuff. Clyde, what else can we expect to see at this year's Bug Fest?
So the theme of the festival this year is beetles, and there's going to be a lot of different kinds of things going on with beetles. We'll have presentations on dung beetles, on fireflies, on other kinds of beetles. There's going to be, an awful lot of fun stuff for the kids to do outside with beetles and with other insects. So I think it's going to be a great event, as it is every year.
So a couple little factoids here that's interesting to me. Weevils are beetles.
Yes.
I never put that together.
Yeah, they're one of the most diverse groups of beetles. If not the most diverse group of beetles.
The other is we talked about the iridescence in these, so these emerald green, these bright iridescent beetle shells. And you say that's not pigment. This is structural in many cases.
Anytime you see a really vivid color, iridescent kind of metallic color on an animal, is a very high probability that it's actually a structural color, not a pigmented color. And it's actually got to do with the ultrastructure of the surface that you're looking at. So bright green beetles, they're not really green. They look green. A morpho butterfly with his brilliant blue wings, it's not really blue. It looks blue. And then a hummingbird, the ruby-throated on a hummingbird. It's not really ruby-throated. It's black. But if the light hits it right, it's ruby.
So does it mean if I kind of like twisted it a little in the sun, it would change color on me?
The colors definitely will change.
Which means the thing I worried about for this poor beetle, which is you're really showing up here. I can see. I don't know if you're worried about predators, but I'm worried for you. Everybody can see you. And you're saying they can hide pretty quickly.
They can. If they get a little shadow on them, that bright color a lot of times is very, very much dimmer.
We only had 17 and a half minutes to tell you about beetles, but if you want to see more, you go to Bugfest, September 21st at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. And my thanks to Clyde Sorensen, who's a professor of entomology at NC State, and Kelly Oten is a Forest Health Monitoring Coordinator for North Carolina Forest Service. Thank you both for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
You can find out more at Bugfest and about Bugfest, the 24th annual, I should say, September 21st. So don't get that confused, but do go to our website, stateofthings.org. And we have links to all of that. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Grant Hollab-Mormon. Robin Copley is our technical director. Jenny Lawson engineered the show today. Josie Taras is our intern, and North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.